This is CliffCentral.com.
From only 8 employees to over 8,000, Stephen Kosseff's journey of entrepreneurship has seen lots of growth, many ups, many downs, a front row seat to some of the biggest changes in South Africa's economy, and he's here sitting in front of me today. Now, you've finished with Investec. Are they still, do they haul you in there for things, or you're not allowed to do anything anymore?
No, I can do consulting for them.
Yeah.
But I'm not in any formal process. I do client functions. I do, if there's something they want some view on, I can do that. I'm still chairman of the committee that's demerging Investec Asset Management.
Right.
So I do have some role to play, but I'm in the cooler for a year.
Yeah, so what does being in the cooler mean? What are you not allowed to do?
I'm not allowed to be on any boards, in any decision-making processes, anything like that.
Is that driving you mad?
No.
I mean, you're
I'm on other boards, not Investec boards.
Not Investec boards. But no. But you have never, ever had a down day in your life. I mean, you're always busy.
Yeah, mostly, unless I'm on holiday.
Now, where does this energy come from? I mean, were you always like this as a kid as well?
Yeah, always a bit boisterous. I liked playing sport as a kid. Then I got lazy when I got older.
Yeah.
And so I worked.
Well, work is, there's one way of putting it. You started one of the most successful businesses in the country. I mean, you started it with some partners.
Yeah, I didn't really start it. Ian Cantor and two other guys, Larry Nested and late Errol Graham, when he passed away last year, started it, and then Bernard and I joined a couple of years later. But we joined, I was the 8th employee.
That's unbelievable.
So I'm employee number 10, because 2 had left.
But when you look at what a huge juggernaut it is now, and how there's London, there's Australia, there's America, there are all these things going on at the moment that keep you in various places at various times doing really important things. I mean, could you ever have imagined this stuff when you started off?
So I remember we used to be corner 162 Anderson Street, corner Anderson and Moy.
Yeah.
That was our office, and Ian Cantor and I used to walk to the Carlton Centre for meetings. And one day we were walking back from the Carlton Centre, and we were doing deals for doctors and accountants. Those were our clients, lending money for equipment and cars. He said, no, one day we'll be like Salomon Brothers. So I thought to him, what? Salomon Brothers, yeah, we're going to be doing these 40 million rand deals, etc., which in 1980 probably was a big number. Salomon Brothers in 1980 was like Goldman Sachs or today.
Right. They were the monsters.
Yeah, and then they were run by a guy called John Gutfriend, who they got caught rigging the U.S. Treasury market, and that was the end of Salomon Brothers. It ended up being part of, I think, Citibank. Salomon Smith Barney, that ended up going into Citibank at a point in time. But they were what Goldman's are today. And so that's what I thought, oh, who's this guy? Well, I'm not too, Ian, what rubbish are you talking now?
Yeah.
So he had this kind of vision, but he left us in 1984. He went to Holland, immigrated, and he started a new business, which Investec were originally the owner of and eventually became a partner, which has now been sold and part of something else. And so Bernard and I took the baton in 1988, roughly, on our own. And he brought in an executive chair, a guy who was from Barlas, a really good guy, Bas Cardle. He was a Dutch guy, was an industrialist. And he didn't know anything about banking. And he said to Ian, you know, I'll come in as an executive chair, but you have to have a banker run it. So I was the banker. And Bernard was my chief operating officer. So we worked together as a team. I became CEO in 1996, because after the bus, we brought in Hugh Herman from Pick and Pay, who became executive chairman, and I was still what was called the managing director. And then in 1996, I became the CEO, but effectively running the business from 1988, having joined in. I joined part-time in 1978 as a youngster, when I created a joint venture with Investec. I worked in an accounting firm, my late dad's accounting firm, and I started a thing called Investec Leasing East Rand. Used to finance doctors in the East Rand.
Interestingly enough, are there any of those doctors whose practices may still be banking with Investec all these years later?
Yeah, a lot.
And are these people also people who will occasionally call you up?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Even now.
The relationships now, huh?
Yeah, because you built a relationship business. You know, I think that one thing we always prided ourselves in at Investec is being user-friendly, being contactable. People, you know, could phone the CEO, could phone my colleague Bernard, could phone any of us.
Yeah.
Even today, they still phone. They got a problem with Investec, or can I help them, or can we do that, or they did this wrong, or they did that wrong. So we've always been open as an organization and built a client-facing business that's very user-friendly. That's what we attempted to do in life.
And there are two things here that I need to know from you. Number one, are the people who start a business or who take it from the point where you took over always the best people to run it when it grows to this monster? And number two, how do you get it to stay in terms of the culture the way that it was when you started off, with relationships between individuals, people could call you up? How do you get that to stay when it morphs into something so much bigger?
So I think you firstly, it's around people. You've got to have the type of people that are happy to be in a culture that is non-hierarchical, open, transparent. Anyone can confront anybody about anything.
But hang on, in the 80s, that was never the case.
Yeah, but we started
like
days,
that. I mean, that was revolutionary then, because
there were organizations that there were writings about, you know, how organizations should function. You get autocratic, hierarchical organizations, mm-hmm. and you get what we called connected organizations, where organizations are connected more by concentric circles than hierarchical charts, where relationships become very, very important. And there were writings by a guy, Edgar Schein, a professor at MIT in the early 80s, around, you know, how to build these types of organizations. There was a very good professor who came on a bit later in life. He passed away in 2004, a guy, Samantra Ghoshal, who spoke about, he was an Indian guy, but he worked in INSEAD for many years and then at London Business School. And he wrote about organizational culture, structures of organizations. He wrote about a thing called the smell of the place. When you walk into an organization, what is the smell of the place? Is it a controlled type environment, or is it an environment where, people are the most important thing in the environment? You have a strong purpose and you have strong people. So you get different types of cultures and different types of structures. And hierarchical structures work for some organizations that don't work for others. We never built a hierarchical organization. You have to have structure because you're a financial institution. So you have to have strong compliance, risk processes,
sure. All
those things to keep regulators satisfied and defend yourself against, I'll put them in a generic term, the crooks. But your best line of defense are to have people with integrity, people who know what is right and what is wrong. And that those people maintain your code of ethics. You can have rules, but rules can always be broken. So it's better to have philosophies which define what is right and what is wrong. And then philosophies are very difficult to break. Rules are very easy to break because you get around them. Philosophies, when you test, you say, is that within our code of ethics? And it's very hard to break that principle. But a rule, easy.
So when you're busy putting together the philosophies that are going to guide a business, which also has, I mean, you've got strong intellectual capital there. You've got very, very smart people working for you. You've got a good understanding of the environment, the economy, the fundamentals, all of that stuff. But these things permeate through all of that. How do you find them? I mean, where do you get your inspiration for that kind of idea? Is it from religion? Is it from, you mentioned, professors at MIT and people who've spent their entire academic lives developing this stuff? And then you have the benefit of reading it. I mean, not everybody bothers to look into this stuff if they're bankers. Some of them tend to be very practical people.
Yeah, some of them are very clinical.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just about the deal. And which in the early days, people said, bankers are poor managers. And certainly merchant bank, we called ourselves a merchant bank in the early days, very poor managers because they don't care about people, they care about the deal.
Right.
But when you start realizing that, it's people who make the difference, then you start focusing on people. You start focusing on growing and developing people, giving people the ability to be themselves, within constraints always, but still to be themselves, and not to be scared to innovate, not to be scared to challenge, because challenge is an important thing. Bosses don't know everything. Often you've got much smarter people working for you, and if you don't let them question and challenge, then what happens is they get stifled and they leave. So you want good people to flourish, you have to have an open culture that says anyone can talk to anybody about anything. So we had open plan. We never had titles. We had functional titles, not status titles.
Right.
So you may have been a managing director, but you were a managing director of a business, and that was your functional title. Doesn't mean to say you were better than someone who served you in the dining room.
Right.
Because you didn't have more status. You had equal status as an employee, equal voice. But you had a bigger role.
Now, that brings me to something that I've wanted to ask you for a long time. People really like you. They know you're a no-bullshit guy. They know you speak truth to power. You talk straight. You don't really care if someone's a president or a king or if they're the tea girl, because you treat them all the same,
yeah.
Which I think is a tremendous character trait, and it's something which you must have worked on, but also it's something that some people just have. And I think you just have it, because your personality can give the impression to people that it's difficult to talk to you. I mean, that you might not be approachable to someone who doesn't know you very well. However, it is my experience in the time that we've spent together that you're very approachable. You're happy to talk about anything, and you'll spend time. So how do you figure that you get to a point where this is the situation with someone in a position like yours, which was a prominent position? You've advised presidents. You've had to do with massive, massive decisions that have an impact on the local and the international economy. How do you keep it grounded?
I just think we're all human beings. I think at the end of the day, my wife always told me, I've got a tough wife, which is a good thing. Put your hand in water. You think you're important. Put your hand in water.
Yeah.
Take it out, and you see how long the ripple is. Not long. That's how important you are. So you know, I used to, at work, I was, you know, the CEO. At home, I was sometimes the village idiot. And so it grounded me a lot. And you've got to be very careful that you don't fall in love with your position, because it's very easy for that position to go. Very easy for them. You know, we've seen accidents in life. We've seen people who had very powerful positions disappear. And I'm not saying die, but just disappear from that position. And then how do they cope with being what they were?
Yeah.
So I think you must always remain very grounded. Now, I grew up in Benoni. I went to multicultural school. Okay, it was in the apartheid era, so they were all a bunch of whiteys, but from very different backgrounds. They were, you know, poor people, very wealthy people, middle-of-the-road people. And you learn to get on with everything, everyone. So it's important that, you know, whether you're dealing with the waiter in the restaurant.
Yeah.
Treat everyone with dignity and respect.
But Stephen, you've been very successful. That's undoubtedly the case. How did you measure your success? Because you didn't know, as you were telling me the story just now about how you and Ian were discussing the Salomon brothers. You didn't know how much better it could get, how much more you guys could achieve. How were you measuring yourself, and how were you measuring the business while it was happening?
So, yeah, I'm probably quite competitive by nature. So you measure yourself against who you're competing with. And sometimes, you know, you've got to look backwards to understand how far you come from
but
where
who,
you came.
Who were those people? Because we had major banks that had advantages over you guys in the beginning.
Yeah, well,
were they your competitors? Who were you looking
at?
No,
we never looked
at them. International people?
Yeah, more international people. You know, who's created? Because we always were outward looking as a firm. So we always saw early days in our history that if we're going to be what we want to be, then we have to be able to go play away games. We can't just stay here. So out of all our competitors that we started out against, you know, the the one that's still around, it's exceptionally successful, is the First Rand Group Rand Merchant Bank, the Rand Merchant Bank piece of the First Rand Group. Mm-hmm. And they went a route of, you know, going retail in SA by taking over Barclays at the time. Or First Rand, I can't remember if it was Barclays or First, but they took over First Rand from, I don't know, it was owned by probably mostly Anglo-American at a point. And they made a massive success out of it. The other guys all disappeared that we competed against. You know, Board of Executors was a good company that got rolled into Nedbank when they had that crisis in the early 2000s. It was a so Mark Brown actually came from there, so did Tom Boardman. Yeah. So they were a good firm. And but they actually came, Mark came from a thing called Natal Building Society, because we used to have old building societies. Yeah, you know, you've seen a lot of people disappear on the way.
Yeah.
So we always had, you know, international ambitions, and you said, well, who are you going to be like? Okay, so you've got Goldman's in the U.S., which started life as a partnership. So we had a partnership culture. You've seen very successful firm in Australia called Macquarie Bank. Very, very successful. Also, you know, similar style, not outside the big four, but a very effective global firm, you know, run by a fantastic lady now, who comes actually from Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. Her family came from Sri Lanka. And so you say, and then, you know, you always had the Rothschild group, and you had Schroders in the UK was an asset manager and an investment bank in the early days. They sold their investment bank to Citibank, in about 2001, and then they just became an asset manager. So, you know, okay, we Investec are doing that now, demerging actually, as opposed to selling anything, because they still kept the brand Schroders. So Investec Asset Management are moving to a brand called 91, which is the year Hendrik de Toy started with us. So it's a lot of it's about, you know, building incremental. I always say, if you build something incrementally over a long period of time, and you hit tough times, but the resilience gets you through.
Right.
So when you look back 30 years later, 40 years later, you say, yeah, we came from, you know, 8 people you said 8,000, over 10,000 as a combined group. We came from 8 to 10,000, where we had a 3 million rand balance sheet when we started, no third party money under balance sheet. Now we have a trillion rand balance sheet if I combine
sure.
UK and South Africa. We have 3.3 trillion of third party funds under management, maybe three because the rand's weakened, about 3.4 trillion of third party money under management. So if you combine the two, you're almost looking after SA GDP from 3 million rand.
Amazing.
You know, making 280,000 rand profit in March 2003, I mean 1983, I'm getting 1981.
Mm-hmm.
I get confused with numbers sometimes, but
which is alarming for a bank.
Huh? Yeah, but 1981 we made 280,000 rand to, you know, probably 11 billion rand today. So, but it's, you know, you never sort of on the way, you know, thought you'd got to where you need to be. You're always trying to go that extra step. Sometimes you have flat seasons where you can't go anywhere because life is just too tough. You know, the last, since post the financial crisis, we had to deal with a shakeout in the international businesses. South Africa carried on growing,
mm-hmm.
Notwithstanding the last 10 years where South Africa itself as a country did not grow. Our business still grew. And you know, we had to reshape the business internationally. And now I think, you know, we've got ourselves into position. Okay, I'm no longer CEO, but Investec's got itself in a position where it's ready for the next phase of its growth and development, being able to afford to give shareholders, you know, 70% of its holding in Investec Asset Management as a, it's not really a special dividend, but they'll end up with a new share, but it is like a special dividend. So you know, we couldn't have done that 3 or 4 years ago while we were busy reshaping and dealing with, you know, you had 2008 financial crisis global. Then you had 2010 Ireland blew up. We had a business in Ireland. Then 2012 Greece blew up. So you had a European crisis. Then 2016 we caught this whole Brexit saga.
In the meantime,
South African growth rate had stumbled to 1%, if that. So it's been a pretty tough season.
Now, when you talk about a tough season, I mean, one of the things that you're called on often to comment on is the state of our local economy. You've been a big supporter, a very vocal supporter of South Africa, a very vocal supporter of President Cyril Ramaphosa. I know you're not the only one. You've been involved in conversations behind the scenes through a number of our crises, some of them quite public, which involved, you know, standing up to government and saying, listen, if you want to look after things here, if you want to have any money left at the end of the day, you better take care of this and this and this. Yeah. But how do you think we're faring at the moment? A lot of people are very frustrated with the progress we've made or haven't made. A lot of people are very angry about the lack of growth. They say that the economy as it is at the moment is unsustainable. Yeah. I mean, how are you feeling?
Yeah, look, I think I share some of the frustration. I'm obviously an optimist, so I try and see the other side. I think some very tough decisions have to be made. I think putting SA into business rescue was a fairly tough decision for the ANC, where they come from. You know, they talk this developmental state.
And they like collective responsibility.
I wish they'd been that and say, I want a growth economy and not a developmental state.
Right.
You will get development if you grow.
Right.
And we all understand, as South Africans, the need to uplift society, the need to make a difference. And we do a hell of a lot more than other corporates in the world in terms of the work we do on social upliftment and trying to make a difference, because obviously we have a big conscience about our history. And we all need to do that. But you're not going to do it, and you're not going to be successful unless you grow. And the way we structure it at the moment, we're not going to grow. And I'm just thinking about this electricity issue. Why does the Minister of Mines and Energy not hand out... I don't like the concept of licenses. They should just create a regulatory framework that says, comply with XYZ and you can
join the power grid.
Yes.
You can contribute power. And, you know,
exactly.
These independent power producers are sitting there. Some of them have been waiting 4 years to contribute.
Yeah, and they've got... And some of them have got already... creating surplus energy, they can't sell it to anyone because they're only allowed to sell it to Eskom. It is actually absurd. And the guy sits there not doing anything, and we're in a crisis. So
this debt of Eskom's, I'm curious, because you've worked with big numbers your whole life, and you've financed things, and you've helped people who have money to make more money, and you've helped people who didn't have any money to get some. And you look at something like Eskom, I mean, it's been managed probably worse than any corporation in human history. They were a monopoly. They charged more for less of their product. All the rules of supply and demand seem to have been suspended.
Not there.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah, and then it's a monopoly.
A monopoly. And they've got bailed out and bailed out.
A state monopoly on top of it.
Correct. We did things like pay R1 billion to the Guptas for coal. We didn't get one piece of coal from them. Up front, we paid them.
It was 600 and something.
Unbelievable, though. If I said, Stephen Kosseff, there's... whatever you want, you can have the whole of the Free State if you want it. You could have an island somewhere in the Caribbean. Please help us sort out Eskom. Where do you even start to tackle that?
So I think the president appointed a task team. The task team were very capable. They came up with some very good ideas. There were other groups that helped with how you restructure Eskom financially. You can't generate the income that is required to service that debt. You know, I'll go...
It's too huge.
2007, they had R40 billion of debt. They had EBITDA, which is cash flow, of R15 billion. They had 42,000 megawatts, of which 38,000 were available. And they had 32,000 people. Today, they have 44,000 megawatts, of which I don't think 30,000 are available. I think that's why we got load shedding, because you need above, I think, 30,000. So they have 46,000 people, not 32,000. So they hardly have any more capacity with 50% more people. Their EBITDA is doubled from 15 to 30. Okay, you've got inflation, so
sure.
It goes up a bit. But their debt
ballooned
is you know, 11-fold. 11-fold. So the ratio that banks will look at is, what is my debt to EBITDA? So I go from 2.7, which is fundable. Okay, it's, you know, for utility, maybe in South Africa, you can go to 4 maximum.
Sure.
Debt EBITDA ratio to 15. It's not, you know, you either have to convert 350 billion of the 450, or you can have my affordable debt to me is maximum 120 with the current structure. Okay, so you've got to convert a whole lot of debt to equity because the money's spent and it's gone.
Yeah.
Or you've got to come up with a new model. And to me, the new model is fine. Let the government own the grid. Maybe you have some private subgrids, municipalities, etc. Some of them do have their own grids.
Right.
Let all generation be competitive and free game. And the private and the government grid buy from the generators. Let everyone who wants to put solar on their roof
do it.
Go to the grid.
Yeah, whatever you've got left, you can sell back.
You sell back. You know, I've got a friend in Australia built a new house, 250 square meters, put 20 solar panels on his roof. The Sydney Electric pay him 50% of tariff. Maybe they might have dropped it a bit now, but that was what they're paying. His electricity bill's $100 a quarter. I mean, it's, but they are getting electricity at 50% of tariff.
Sure.
Which is probably much cheaper than they're generating it. So these are things we can do. It's not a one-day game, though. It's going to take time to fix.
But there almost seems to be an ideological break on any kind of progress here. And no one can be blamed for this but the political parties and their ideologies themselves. Because it seems to me that despite all the evidence to the contrary, that capitalism, not unfettered, you know, crony capitalism, we're talking about the rules of supply and demand, the free market, this has empowered more people on earth than any other single creation of humankind. The free market is the very best mechanism because it taps into everyone's brain to decide the price of this, to decide whether or not that's acceptable, whether or not this is. And there's competition. So if you don't follow the rules,
important.
You get played out, right?
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me that there are still people in this country who, for whatever reason, are attached to ideas that were made up by Karl Marx over 200 years ago, and they think that this stuff is still implementable.
Yeah, look, I think that's where I take a lot of flack, because they see me as Margaret Thatcher's brother, and I think she did very good things for England, and I think you know, some people will never like her because she closed down certain industries that were defunct.
Yeah,
those are the tough decisions you're going to have to take. You know, today, manufacturing, there is a lot of automation in manufacturing. If you want to compete with the world, you have to automate. Otherwise, you can't compete. So you know, don't say you can't automate. You've got to manufacture and you've got to live in the dark ages. Allow competition. We're not just competing with ourselves. We're competing with the global world. And we have to be able to compete with the global world. Otherwise, where's your advantage?
So isn't it short-sighted to imagine that just because people won't be doing manual labor that they'll suddenly find themselves not useful in an economy? They'll find new ways to make themselves useful, and there'll be jobs that will be different, but they'll find a place.
So there might be an adjustment process you have to go through, like probably the Brits had to go through when the coal mines closed down, and some of those people had to leave those mining towns because they became less relevant. They've tried to create new industries in some of them successfully, in many instances unsuccessfully in others. But you need to, that's why people need to be flexible, adaptable. Education is very important. And you know, the youth of today are going to not going to do jobs for life. The gig economy is going to be very important. They're going to be people who look after themselves a lot more.
The four biggest companies in the world now, companies that could not have existed before the internet or computers, right?
Yeah.
And they've created value out of nothing, effectively.
Yeah.
And who knows what the next wave of industry will be that will be created out of something that doesn't have to be a bricks and mortar store or business, or the kind of stuff that you started financing in 1980. Right?
Yeah, I think the world will continue to shift. There will continue to be brilliant ideas that are going to change our lives. I mean, I'm sitting here, I've got my iPhone here, was created in 2006. My iPad, 2010.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm on, I don't know, my 7th, 8th generation of this iPad.
Use it all the time?
Yeah, I don't carry paper. So, and these things didn't exist 10 years ago.
No.
Now, look how much value they've added to society. If I want to pay my accounts or transfer money from this account to that account or buy unit trust, I just go on my phone.
Yeah.
And I do it. You couldn't do that 10 years ago properly. You know, to go on a computer. And 20 years ago, you couldn't do it at all.
You'd have to go into the branch.
Yeah. Oh. So that's, liberating people. Not constraining them. We are liberated because we can do things that much quicker. And that's why I'm an optimist. I think, new technology changes lives. Maybe you got more leisure time.
But it's growing. It's growing the
cake. But there will be other stuff to do.
There's more for everybody in a world like that.
If you analyze South Africa over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I say financial crisis, everyone went backwards. So let's go from 2010. We grew at 3% in 21, 20, we grew at 3 and then 3.4, 2011, and then downhill to an average of below 2 over the last, till 20, if I go up to 2018. So I've got Annabel Bishop to work out what is the cost of GDP if we had gone back to our pre-crisis growth rate, because most people don't know that we were growing at over 4. In fact, the last, in 2006, I think we grew at between 5 and 6. We had a budget surplus. South Africa, from the 330 billion deficit the minister spoke about the other day, we actually had a surplus in the 2007 calendar year. 2008 budget, he would have said we had a surplus as a country. Our debt to GDP was 26%. Not this 60 cruising to 80. So, had we grown, most emerging markets went back to their pre-crisis growth rate. They've slowed a bit now because the world is slowing, but they went back to their pre-crisis growth rate. If we'd grown at 4.25 on average from 2010 to today, we would have had an extra gross GDP in 2018 would have been about 1.28 billion rand higher than it currently is. The cumulative.
I mean, that's outpacing a lot of countries in the supposed first world, right?
Yeah, because you're an emerging market, you should grow faster. You're less developed. But if I accumulate that, it's 3.5 trillion rand of lost GDP. If then I say tax as a percent of GDP was, 26 to 28%, it was at 28, it slipped down under that other fella to 26. I think Ed Kieswetter had to maybe get it back up to 28, okay, which is a reasonable amount. That loss would have been 350 billion rand of extra revenue for the state. The cumulative effect of that means our debt to GDP would not have been 60, it would have been 30. Our rating would not be BBB minus negative outlook or below the cusp. It would have been BBB plus looking for upgrades. And we would have had much less unemployment. Adrian Gore had worked out that we would have had 16% unemployment, not 29. Okay.
And we would have been building people houses and putting in infrastructure.
That's it. And you would have had confidence.
Yeah.
So the pie would have been bigger, and government would have had much more fiscal space to build the schools that are needed, to put the water into villages that are needed.
And then you can talk about things like a national health insurance
Even the way they do national, if I was listening to Zweli coming in to this session with you, and I wasn't quite listening because I just get cross because it's again this whole centralized approach.
Yeah.
So, how do you do national health? And I think national health is a very important thing for people, but just make sure that you do it in a way that is decentralized enough that it's going to work, that it's going to be functional. If you centralize everything, it's not going to work. So you have to ensure that people can claim, but let them go to whatever service provider they want. And they must not be the only service provider. Then you get an Eskom. If they're the only insurance, you get an Eskom.
And government's proven, I'm afraid, too many times, and it's cost us far too much money, that the state is not the best machine for managing things. We have an incredible private health system in this country in terms of businesses like you mentioned, Adrian Gore's, that he's built.
Yeah, no, they've built, and they've been incredible. Only 20-something years old.
Absolutely, and we're exporting that idea to other countries, right?
Yeah.
Countries that are supposedly more advanced than us. Now, if they sat down and listened to what the private healthcare sector has to say in this country, we could figure a system that might work across the board for people. But yeah, it's going to require both, and you can't take control of it and pull it into government and expect it to work. The same people who managed Eskom.
No, you don't. You know, and that's where the delusional thinking comes. Is, I don't want to use the word arrogance, but there's an arrogance that government think that they can do a hell of a lot more than they actually can do. Mm. And that's the problem. And you're not attracting, you know, the best skills into government. You know, in other societies, developed world societies, people are interchangeable between government and the private sector, because the society is at a level of skill that, you know, it works. South Africa has a massive skill shortage. And you know, they talk about 800,000 skills that we are short as a society. That's why we got so much unemployment, because we don't have enough skills to carry the size of our population.
Right.
Because each skill creates 3 to 5 jobs.
But it's not as if you only talk macroeconomics. You get involved in Project Water, for example, something I want to talk to you about.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. You know, we've created this NGO. It was operating in Africa. It was a Israeli-American NGO putting water into villages.
It's amazing.
So we will by March have done about 60 villages. The moment we backed by Investec started it, did 11, and then Nati Kirsch, who was an ex-South African, but he made his money in America, building a thing called
Jetro.
He's trying to give back, and he's prepared to. He's put a lot of money in, and by March we'll have 60 villages, and hopefully we can get to a lot more as we get more people on board. And that's without any government help. And if you see what they do, it's phenomenal how they go into the village, they get all the people on side, they get the village to have ownership, village do maintenance, they look after the tower. It's all driven by solo, it's monitored. The people no longer have to walk, the woman walk 5 kilometers, go get dirty water from a stream. They don't get sick anymore. The water's clean. Sometimes you have to chlorinate it to make sure it's okay, because not all the water underneath is clean. But it works hell of a
it's
well.
It's incredible.
There's in each village there, you know, 3 to 10,000 people.
Yeah, and obviously water we take for granted in most parts of the world now, but there are places where they still don't have this, and this is making a life and death difference for some people.
Yeah, and surprising it in South Africa, which is, you know, a middle income economy that we have. When I first spoke to this individual, I said, "You got to come. We got to do this in South Africa." He said, "You don't need it. You a developed economy."
We do. There are parts of rural South Africa.
I don't know how many villages. I thought 400. Someone said, "No, you're dreaming. They're much more. Don't have villages. Don't have water. Sometimes they have infrastructure, but the sources drop. Now money's disappeared on the way. So money might have been set aside, but it's disappeared on the way.
So even in places like water provision, the private sector can play a role, but philanthropy obviously is a big part of that as well. I mean, I know Nati Kirsch is also doing a lot of entrepreneurship and stimulation to the Swazi economy in terms of growing hundreds and hundreds of tiny little businesses, a woman who sews, a woman who makes beads.
No, he's done phenomenal work.
It's absolutely incredible to see. And I know you do this too, and you spend a lot of your time outside of work giving people free advice. You help people along with their little businesses. You are available to lots and lots of South Africans. It's something that you do quietly on the way while you're doing other things.
No, I'm not in the coffee shop, 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah. You get tired, ever?
No.
How does that happen? Please teach the rest of us. I mean, like, how do you... Because some people would say, you know what? Stephen Kosseff's made this incredible success of his life. He's built up this awesome business. He's done a lot of good along the way, too. Why doesn't he just take it easy now?
Because what's taking it easy? You know, it's I'm not someone who likes to. I play a bit of golf, And I try walk on the weekends with my wife. But I'm not someone who is going to go to the coast and do carpentry. And it's not my factory setting. Okay, my factory setting, looking at balance sheets, seeing if a business will work or not. I do like.
Is that what gives you the nachas? That looking at the balance sheets?
What I like is the social responsibility stuff. So I chair some of the Investec foundations.
Right.
Not the ones Investec created, but their clients created. And we allocate the money. And you must see what the work that people are doing. You know, in early childhood development.
Yeah.
In all sorts of areas where people are making a big difference to society. And you know, food delivery to schools, you know, taking, yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable what people are actually doing out there to try and help make a difference. And so I'm very interested in that aspect, is because I've always believed, you know, and we use a slogan a lot in investing, we don't live, you know, off society, we live in it. And even, you know, I think capitalism got a bad name because it's, when I did my MBA, the role of cap, you know, the business was to maximize profits. I think you've got to get the right return on equity to meet the needs of your stakeholders. Otherwise, they won't invest in you. But this concept,
it's not mercenary.
The concept of maximization is not how capitalism should be modeled for the future. And you're starting to hear a lot of business leaders say, you know, we understand this was what we were, but if we don't make a big difference to uplift people and give them opportunity, then, you know, they're going to go, they'll forget the hardships that were created by, you know, the communism or socialism, and how those economies didn't grow, and they'll go back to that model. I mean, the UK is at risk today in the election of if the Labour Party win, what. Those guys are quite radical. They're taking it back 50, 60 years.
Not to mention a whole bunch of other things that are unsavory about
them. Yeah.
But what would be your ideal outcome here in the UK, for example, just from the point of view of having understood that market, Investec-wise, and seeing how much it's been dithering under this Brexit, aren't we situation?
So, look, I think at the end of the day, markets need certainty.
Right.
What I would have voted for Remain, I would have thought, you know, open society, movement of people,
sure.
You know, create the right environment and all the clever people come and they build their businesses and do whatever they have to do.
The City of London model, really.
Yeah, very open, yeah, that's a very vibrant place, mm-hmm. The City of London. But at the end of the day, you know, unfortunately these guys, I was shocked, voted to leave, and you can't just sit in this dither space.
Yeah.
So, today I would say, okay, and I've heard a lot of people who historically were Labour voters, you know, Tony Blair people, who say, I can't vote for Labour. I can't vote for Liberal Dems because they're too wishy-washy, although some of their stuff I believe in because I'm a Liberal. But I'll have to vote for the Conservatives because I can't.
So, ideally, whether it's for better or for worse, Boris needs a mandate.
Yeah.
This decision needs to be made. And we'll deal with the consequences.
The only thing is, he needs a strong enough mandate so the right of his party can't hold him to ransom.
Correct.
So he can do orderly exit, Brexit.
What do you think of Donald Trump? You must be asked this every day.
Yes. You know, he's not my cup of tea because the guy, he's not statesman. He just shoots from the hip.
But you do that. And if we voted you in for president, they'd say the same thing about you.
No. I think about what I say.
Of course you do.
And I don't tweet. So you don't see me on social media. I think...
So he's not a refined man. We know that.
No.
There's no diplomacy there.
No. I would be very happy if Michael Bloomberg came in and won. Because I think he's got the wherewithal. Like, obviously, he's very rich, and they probably won't let him run for the Democrats. But he's a guy who's been Republican sometimes, Democrat other times.
But he's not left enough for the nutcases in the Democratic Party. And Donald Trump, up against him, it's gonna turn into a battle of billionaires.
I don't know if Donald Trump is not a patch on him.
No, of course not. No, Bloomberg.
I don't even know if Donald billions are real. I don't know.
I like Bloomberg too, but isn't his job really? He's just trying to pull the Democratic Party a little bit more to the center.
Yeah, well, they should be center left.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think a good factory setting is economically a bit right, socially a bit left.
Absolutely.
And that's what, because on the left, you're helping uplift people. On the right, you are making sure the economy works, because when you go to left, the economy doesn't work. That's what I think is, and that's what Bloomberg will be. Trump, the problem with him is he can do anything. I mean, he can wake up in the morning, yeah, and the North Korean, he loves the guy, it's his best friend, and the guy who's been his partner for decades is disgusting. I mean, I can't, obviously the economy is doing well, but I think it was set up to do well through the 8 years of the previous regime fixing up the place from the financial crisis.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, I like the concept of tax cuts, but, you know, they also run big deficits. So where's the revenue going to come from to do what needs to be done on the other side? So I wouldn't be a supporter of his, but obviously the left of the Democrats I would find terrible.
So Bernie's not on the agenda?
Not for me.
Just briefly, how often do you speak to the guys who started Investec with you? How often do you still talk to them, the ones who are still around?
So Bernard, I talk to, you know, almost every day, a few times a week.
That's great.
Yeah, and occasionally I see him sometimes, and then I chat to him. Mm-hmm. So I saw him the other day, was here.
Mm-hmm.
Larry, one of the original founders, hasn't been in Investec since 1983, but I'm friendly with him, so I see him a lot and talk to him a lot. The other guy, unfortunately, passed away. Glenn Berger, I see most days. Mm-hmm. So I do see him a lot. He's been with us since 1980. And I would talk to him, you know, whenever I need to. So I'm still in touch. There are other people that who were with us on the way that I still talk to. I talk to everyone.
Well, you do talk to everyone. It's one of the reasons I was pleased to see that you'd managed to find some time to talk to us. And I think there are lots of people who are very grateful for your involvement in South Africa's economy, for building a business which went far beyond just creating value for your shareholders. And
they mind we haven't created enough value.
And the stuff that you're doing outside of that, which often goes unheralded. I know you're not doing it for points, but it's really nice to see people playing a massively active role in creating life-changing stuff for people who they might never otherwise encounter. And I know you're one of those people leading the charge. And thanks for giving the government good advice when they bother to listen.
When they bother to listen. They're not in listening mode.
But I'm always listening to you, and I think lots of other people are too. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
This is CliffCentral.com.